This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In virtually every single discussion and report about Detroit's bankruptcy filing, the point is made that this is historic, that Detroit is the largest city in U.S. history to seek bankruptcy protection. But that was nearly not the case. New York City was a hair's breadth away from earning that unenviable distinction in 1975. We wondered what comparisons could be drawn between Detroit's crisis today and New York's in the 70s, and if there are lessons Detroit could learn from New York's recovery. My next guest may have some insights for us. He has taught at Yale for 46 years. He was part of five New York City governments, and he's a noted urban planner, educator, and author. Alex Garvin, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much.
Alex, how close was New York City to going broke in 1975?
It was a matter of days and hours. You may remember there was a famous headline in the New York Daily News, Ford to New York, drop dead.
Yes.
We knew that there was not going to be any money from Washington. What had happened is that we had been spending money we didn't have. That was one of the problems. We were putting our annual spending into the capital budget. That is something that nobody should do. We also were running a deficit, and we were facing the problem of increasing rates of interest. This was the aftermath of the Vietnam War, and there was inflation. And we had bonds that we had put out for more than $1 billion, and they were to finance housing mortgages for working people. And when the buildings were ready to go into permanent financing, nobody wanted to increase the rents.
Mm.
But the interest rates kept going up, and eventually the bank said, sorry, we're not going to lend you any more money. And to give you a sense of how different the response was in New York from everything you've been hearing, when I became the Deputy Housing Commissioner of the City of New York in 1974, I had a staff of 300 people. And when I moved on to be the Director of Comprehensive Planning in 1978, I had 75.
Wow.
We downloaded 20% of the city's working personnel. And nobody is talking about the kinds of things that cities are required to do if they're going to be run intelligently. And I don't see anybody serious in Washington, and I have yet to see what's going to come out of your bankruptcy court.
As you've watched these headlines unfold and the story unfold in Detroit, what in the situation here rings a bell and makes you see connections?
We also had extremely strong unions, and they had negotiated contracts with benefits and costs that the city could not afford.
And which sounds familiar to us here.
Yes, and we had actually to change some of the terms of those deals, and for a period of time, we also had to stop spending money on any kind of capital investment. We had, by the time the money began to flow back, we had potholes in streets, we had dead trees on the streets, we had patches in almost all of the schools, and what we had to do then is to reinvest in our capital plant and equipment, because for a period of 5 or so years, we had been disinvesting, and I know you have the same thing.
You know, as much as we in Michigan suffered from the Great Recession of 2008, that recession of 73 was a very, very tough time for our country and for New York.
It wasn't the recession that caused this. It was maladministration in New York. We had to find $3 billion. Now, of course, today we have a $70 billion budget. I don't remember what the size was back then, but it was a fraction of it. I assure you that finding $3 billion is a very difficult thing, even in a city that had as large a budget as we did. And, of course, you remember that at that time not only did we have a downturn, but President Nixon terminated all the housing programs that were running. We actually had thousands of potential housing sites that we had acquired, relocated people from their homes, torn down the buildings, and we were ready to build up. this was the time that you did the finest urban renewal project, probably one of the two or three in the United States, and that's Lafayette Park.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had sites like that all over New York and no money to build them because Nixon stopped the money.
We're speaking with Alex Garvin, urban planner, educator, and author. He has taught at Yale for 46 years, and he was part of five New York City governments. As we look at New York's brush with bankruptcy in 1975 and what lessons we might learn here in Detroit in terms of what happened in New York. And Alex, what was it that saved New York from bankruptcy?
I think probably the governor. Governor Hugh Carey was determined that New York City would not go bankrupt. He came from Brooklyn, and he worked very hard, and we got an agency set up. I don't remember its name, but the agency's role was to supervise the finances of the city of New York until everything had been put back in order. And the fact that there was an agency that could require the city government to do things allowed the leadership of the city to make those tough choices, and over time we paid back and got the money that we had borrowed. We sold some of our mortgages at a discount, of course. We bought textbooks. We put it in the city's capital budget to be amortized over 30 or 40 years. We stopped doing that. There were accounting practices that we had to adopt, and I believe that the mayor, Abraham Beam, and deputy mayor, John Zuccotti, worked very hard to fulfill the obligations. But that board that supervised the finances made sure that the incoming Koch administration in 1978 didn't do things as they had been done previously. And, of course, we shed a large portion of the city workforce.
Alex, would it be fair to draw an analogy between that board set up by Governor Carey to what's happened here in Detroit with Governor Snyder appointing Kevin Orr as emergency manager with very wide-ranging powers, or no?
No, because he is a bankruptcy lawyer, as I understand
mm-hmm.
it, and the man who was appointed by Carey was an investment banker, and there was a whole committee of people who knew about finance. And we had to borrow money constantly to cover our capital budget. Otherwise, we couldn't repair the schools or the potholes or anything else. And it's a different situation. Also, they had, I think, less powers than your bankruptcy attorney does.
Yes, he does have the powers in that respect. I was getting the sense, as you described that board, that it was able to kind of push the city in directions it might not have gone, but
exactly.
And so emergency manager is doing that, but then some, because he has that absolute power.
But as I understand it, you also had retirement benefits, pensions, and things that were negotiated that are solemn obligations of the city. We didn't yet have them. We're beginning to have them now, I might add. And there's always a chance. I know that New York City is going to face some very tough decisions in the coming year or two, because the entire city workforce, nearly 300,000 people, all are working without a contract. The unions and Mayor Bloomberg were unable to reach an agreement, and the union leadership has announced that not only do they need to have their contracts negotiated and signed, with increases, of course, but they expect back pay at those increased levels. And we already are facing a $2 billion deficit in the next fiscal year. So this is an ongoing problem in many cities, and there are times when the cities are well-run financially.
Mm-hmm.
There are times when the economy is doing well, which makes it easy to do things. What often happens is during those good times, the spending grows instead of reducing the debt at that point.
Alex, how was New York City different, particularly in terms of its business climate, after the recovery from this fiscal crisis? Was there a new power base and a new feel and look to the city?
No. What we had as an advantage is something you do not have, and that is we were coming out of a decline in population. The Immigration Act of 1965 changed New York more than any single thing. So if you asked me who was responsible For the turnaround, I would tell you Lyndon Johnson, because it was during his time that we reopened immigration to the United States, which was closed down in the 20s. And we today have more than 40% of our population having been born in another country. And these people come here, and they're willing to work hard and invest. They start companies. We began to see trading companies that didn't exist, whole neighborhoods which were being abandoned by people who moved to the suburbs were suddenly occupied by a population that thought that this was so much better than what they had at home, whether they came from Russia or China or Latin America. And they came from all those places, and they made a huge difference. The other thing is we are still the financial center of the world. And even though we have competition from London and Singapore and Tokyo and Shanghai, that gives us an edge up. Finding money in New York is something that people do from all over the world. That helped as well.
It certainly seems, as you talk about the impact of immigration, Alex, that definitely echoes conversations that are being held here in Michigan. And even our governor has said, let's get this immigration reform and get these immigrants in here, because they will do exactly what you described, move into the neighborhoods and make it vibrant and set up businesses. So it seems like immigration reform from Washington is a key element in keeping these big cities like Detroit, getting them back to recovery.
I certainly think so. If I had one observation about what is an anti-urban policy, it is the failure of the United States government to pass immigration reform, despite the fact that we now have had two presidents in a row, George Bush and Barack Obama, saying that we ought to do it.
Alex Garvin, as you watch Detroit's bankruptcy story unfold, and based on your experience right there on the front lines of New York's brush with bankruptcy, what advice would you give to Mayor-elect Mike Duggan and his appointees?
Do everything possible to make it easy for people to move to Detroit. Do everything possible to make it easy to operate a business in Detroit. Do everything possible to avoid all of the costs of doing business in Detroit. And that includes private sector actions as well. If that can happen, you have a huge asset. You have a land bank of extraordinary value and location right outside downtown. A number of not just empty lots, but empty buildings that could be filled up. All you need is to collect the taxes from those places, and suddenly you're going to have a revenue stream. I would add, I know every city, ours included in New York, has regulations that make it onerous to run a business. All kinds of papers that have to be filed, fees that have to be paid, regulations you have to obey. If you could remove them, suddenly when somebody had a choice of either moving to one of the suburbs of Detroit or moving to Detroit where the land is cheap and can be almost given away for nothing, you'd find that you'd have these businesses and they would employ people, and that would begin the change in the economic situation in the city.
And what about advice to state lawmakers? Because we have such a history of Detroit and the rest of Michigan, and there's a need to build a greater sense of understanding that we're all one state.
What's lurking underneath that question is something that the United States has yet to deal with everywhere, and that's the problem of race. You have a predominantly white suburban ring and a predominantly non-white Detroit. That has been the product of everything since the Second World War. That's the first thing to deal with, and that's very difficult because you have to be honest about these things. The second thing I would say is we learned that you have to enforce the law. If you don't enforce the law, you're making the neighborhoods, the people who are defenseless, the ones that they live in, dangerous for them. And they're the ones who get hurt. And simple things like fixing broken windows and making sure that there aren't fires and making sure that you don't have potholes and that the regular city government works is vital, because that's what begins to provide people a sense of security, that things will be fixed when they're broken. And then they want to live there, and then they begin to do things. And also, everybody has to assume responsibility. You know, I'll give you my favorite example. New York and Detroit have filthy streets, right?
Okay.
Lots of litter, right?
Yes.
That's not because we have inadequate amounts of people working in the Department of Sanitation. That's because people are throwing things on the sidewalk and on the street. If we had a society that wasn't dropping litter everywhere, whether it's cigarette butts or chewing gum or just plain garbage, suddenly you wouldn't have to spend money on the Department of Sanitation. And start thinking about the sorts of things like that that people can do, which would make a real difference.
That costs not one penny. Alex, from your perspective and what you, from having gone through this experience in New York, do you believe Detroit can recover?
Absolutely. Detroit is one of the great cities of the United States. You have a remarkable asset. Even in this downturn, I have been watching the waterfront of the Detroit River slowly be turned into a linear park. This is a city going bankrupt, and you're creating that. I also think that Lafayette Park is a jewel in the United States, alive and well, integrated, fully occupied, in good condition, in the middle of devastation. You can learn from what happened there. And you also have to stop making foolish decisions like Renaissance Center, which did not save Detroit, but in fact sucked up all the business from the regular streets and the regular buildings and moved them into this complex. Very beautiful, very exciting, but left vacancies in office buildings downtown.
Yeah, yeah. Alex Garvin, it was a real pleasure talking with you.
Mine as well.
Alex Garvin has taught at Yale for 46 years. He was part of five New York City governments, and he's a noted urban planner, educator, and author of The Planning Game, Lessons from Great Cities, and The American City, What Works, What Doesn't.